For starters, we'd like to welcome you all here. Thank you for showing up today. For those of you that don't already know me, my name is David Scruggs. I'm a senior fellow here at CSIS in the Defense Industrial Initiatives Group. This conference is a joint effort organizationally between my group and CSIS's Europe program. This event would not have been possible without the support and the effort of the Fluor Corporation, for which we are extremely grateful. I would also like to acknowledge the efforts of the combined Polish defense staff here in Washington, the Secretary of Defense's staff over in the Pentagon, and my staff here at CSIS, who really do all the work. We're figureheads up here. So much for credits. One administrative note, some of you have noticed that the schedule changed slightly. We're going to have an awards ceremony at the beginning of the speeches instead of at the end of the speeches today. That's to accommodate the Minister of Defense getting over to a meeting at the White House, which got moved up a little bit. So we are going to be very conscious of the clock today, and we're going to be very need to have all your patience and your cooperation as well. I want to put one reference point down, and then I'll get out of the way and let us get started. George Handy. George, are you here? George. From the fall of the Berlin Wall until earlier this year, George ran a series of international action commissions here at CSIS. And the function of these commissions was to get leaders together from the newly transitioning states in Central and Eastern Europe and meet with their U.S. counterparts and start building trust between the institutions and the individuals that were involved in it, where that trust basically had not existed until prior to World War II. So with all of George's efforts over 14 years, the most successful, I would argue, of all of his commissions was this one, the Polish International Action Commission, of which efforts today are an outgrowth of. So the efforts that, George, you put in over 14 years, the relationships that you built here in Washington and in Warsaw are still alive and functioning, and this, why we're here today is an outgrowth of that, so thank you. And with that, I'm going to... With that, I'm going to keep things moving. I'm going to turn this over to Robin Niblett, who's the Executive Vice President here at CSIS and the head of our Europe program. Robin.
David, thank you very much, and thanks for those for getting us started and for helping make this this meeting possible. Knowing that time really is of the essence today, and also the General Grushko has prepared an elaborate and good presentation, I think I'm going to keep my introductions to as limited a time as possible. I know you all know the title today. We're talking about bilateral defense cooperation and the creation of new capabilities for rapidly evolving security environment. And I think there are probably two dimensions we're trying to capture here, both the expeditionary nature of many of the challenges that are being faced by the security infrastructures, by the armed forces, by the defense planners, not only in the United States, but also in Poland. And at the same time, some of the transformation, both in terms of command structures, in terms of military capabilities, and ultimately also in the kind of infrastructure of defense that this is requiring on both sides. So this is a chance, in a way, to compare approaches from the two sides, taking a bilateral look at what is really a much bigger strategic problem for defense planners on both sides of the Atlantic. And for that, we've really got three, I think, perfect speakers to be able to handle it. The Major General Grushko has had command positions in the Golan Heights, in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and just returned, I think, in July from a tour, a command tour, of the General Multinational Division in Central South Iraq. And so he's bringing with us some hands-on experience to this problem, and I look forward to his presentations in a minute. Let me just do each of the introductions at the beginning so we can move smoothly thereafter. I'm delighted that after Major General Grushko, we will have Jim Townsend speaking with us. Jim, I know, is known to most of the folks here in this room, really a great supporter of transatlantic security in his positions in government, most recently the Principal Director for European and NATO policy at OSD, but also somebody who's held senior positions in NATO and who has now made the bold move, I'll use that word advisedly, into the think tank community. That nice relaxed environment in which we work over here, but it's just a real pleasure to have him join the Atlantic Council as director for their international security program. Jim, welcome, and we're delighted we're one of the first to get you on in your new capacity on the talking circuit. Dr. Ken Oscar, who is Vice President for Strategy at the Fluor Corporation. We're delighted to have him join us, not only because of the very supportive role that Fluor is playing with us for this event today, but also because he brings both in his current corporate hat, given the kind of some of the kind of investments and work that Fluor is doing throughout Central Eastern Europe. He can bring both a perspective, I think, as I said at the beginning, of the kind of infrastructure of defense that's necessary, but also somebody who has played on the government side of the ledger, having served as acting Assistant Secretary of the Army for Acquisition, Logistics and Technology, and also as acting administrator for the Office of Federal Procurement Policy at OMB. He's had many other positions as well in the acquisition side, especially for the Army. And so I think each of these individuals is going to bring a particular angle on the problem that we're trying to tackle today. We do have very limited time. I've talked to the General first, who's going to try and condense a 35-minute presentation down closer to 20, and then my colleagues Jim and Ken will follow after that. But let me not take up any more time. I want to leave a little bit of time at the end of this for Q&A if we possibly can. But let me turn first to you, General. Thank you very much for joining us. It's a pleasure and, in fact, an honor to have you with us. We look forward to your comments.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Let me first introduce myself. I'm Major General Edward Gruszka. My permanent assignment in Poland is Assistant to Commander of Operational Command. Before, I served as a Chief of Staff of 2nd Mechanized Corps in Kraków. According to the order of the Minister of Defense, I was assigned to the Polish position as a multinational division commander in Operation Iraqi Freedom. I perceive it is a great honor to have opportunity to command this multinational unit, which consisted of soldiers from 12 nations. For me, it was the second time to participate in Operation Iraqi Freedom. 2 years before, I was commander of the 1st Brigade Combat Team in Karbala and Babil. Today, I have an honor and privilege to give you a brief on the subject presented. Next. My intent is to cover following topics: introduction, the goal of my briefing. Nowadays, Polish armed forces are transforming into modern, technologically skilled one, with main focus on interoperability, mobility, and sustainment. To meet these requirements, it's also necessary to develop capabilities for strategic lift. One of the milestones of this process is participation of the Polish armed forces in Operation Iraqi Freedom. The prioritization in the Polish armed forces spectrum of tasks have been adopted to the most probable future mission of our forces. They consist of the subject mentioned on the slide. Throughout the last 60 years, threats to the national and global security have significantly changed from a large-scale conflict with high-intensity warfighting to asymmetric terroristic achievements. In that respect, structure and task of the armed forces are changing. The operational challenges to land forces may be summarized as follows: the distinctions between warfighting operations and operations under the extended range of tasks is becoming increasingly blurred. This situation posed special challenges to the troops' deployment. Next. Characteristic features of asymmetric threats we armed forces have to faced during current and foreseen operations other than war are listed above. Taking into account this new spectrum of tasks, Poland is participating in numerous peace support operations. This slide is showing our current deployment either in support of US-led, NATO, European Union and United Nations operations. MNDCS 6, I had a great honor to comment, is the biggest Polish unit deployed abroad with a peace support operation and definitely one of the most difficult and dangerous. Next. The slide is, depicts the deployment of FMNI forces. MNDCS is located in the central part of the Iraq and is neighboring with three other divisions and with Iranian border. MND North, MND Baghdad, and British MND South East. Next. MNDCS is subordinated to MNCI and the land component of MNFI in Iraq. Next, please. Next. New MNFI campaign plans operational tasks will be conducted through executing decisive, shaping, and sustaining operations during three phases. First, stabilization, next, restoration of civil authority, and the last one, during 2008 and 9, support to self-reliance. Next. According to MNFI campaign plan, end state will be reached through executing five lines of operation and achieving following strategic effects. And, of course, end state. At first, let me say that both area operation and task of MNDCS have been permanently changing since the beginning of the operation. We started with almost 10,000 soldiers from 25 countries deployed in 12 bases in five provinces. The character of the mission was changing over 3 years, starting from stabilization in first three rotation. Next. Then due to political decision taken by troops contribution nations and current situation, the character of next mission changed into training and advising. Now our multinational division poses approximately 2,000 soldiers from 12 countries deployed in two bases in two provinces, Al-Qudisiya and Wasit. Next. Since the end of 2005, there are two provinces in MDC area of operation, with the total area of over 25,000 square kilometers and populations almost 2 million Shia and Sunni Arab. The ethno-religious situation within these two provinces are dominated by Shiites. The majority of the Sunnis live in northwest Wasit province. Next, please. The essential facts about the political situation in Iraq the MNDCS had to function under are listed above. In general, it can be summarized as instability. Next, please. Instability enables all kinds of anti-Iraqi forces to organize and gain ordnance. At the moment, they are operating much more intensively than in 2003, 4, or 5. The character presents a number of attacks since June 2003 till May 2006. I must add that on the last period of 2006, situation got even worse. Next. Next, please. Next. MNCI mission statement. MNCI commander's intent. and division mission statement. Our intent and our end state. MNDCS attains the desired and state when provincial Iraqi control is achieved in both provinces. Iraqi security forces are in the lead for security in the provinces according to the tasks. Iraqi people accept the provincial government. MNDCS forces are positioned in operational overwatch. Next. Key our task according to five lines of operations: security, governance, economic development, communicating, and transition. Next, please. The important fact we had to take into account was the multinationality on MNDCS and the personal strengths. We had 12 troop contributing nations, which provide in total 1,900 soldiers. Poland is the lead nation with 900 troops. Next. Taking into account the mission and the key task on the hand and we force on the other, the following division structure was established for the 6th rotation and the same for 7th rotation. On the presented scheme, U.S. contribution is very well viewed. American troops under MNDCS TACON and general support provided the division with all spectrum of support to include communication, intelligence, transition teams and others. I have to stress it was an efficient and harmonious cooperation. Next. MNDCS cooperated with the adjacent formations like our colleagues from MND Baghdad, from MND North, from MND South East. In our area of operations, we had got 8 Iraqi Army Division, which consists of more than 9,000 troops and more than 20,000 Iraqi police services and about 2,000 Iraqi border police. Next, please. In both MNDCS forward operating bases and on all level of command, there were maintained forces ready for immediate reaction on any direct threat or attacks from anti-Iraqi forces. This chart shows respective reserves detachments designated for engagement due to escalation of threat. QRFs, tactical reserves, and strategic reserve from US side and from Polish side. Next, please. In cooperation with the U.S. troops located in Quebeco, an additional QRF was established to support MNDCS and coalition forces. Next. In connection of the first line of operation, providing health care to coalition forces and designated personnel, MNDCS medical service used organic national contingent medical treatment facilities supported by assets of the superior to include level 3rd hospital of the 10th combat support hospital located in Baghdad and north of Baghdad in Talil. Next, the slide shows the medevac coverage in the MNDCS area of operation. There were US medevac, Polish medevac conducted by our helis and of course in both camps there were also land medevac. Next. Logistic assets available in order to accomplish the MNDCS mission came from three general sources: MNDCS logistic units, national support elements, and U.S. Supporting structure, both military, 16 core support group, and civilian KBR. Next, MNDCS G4 areas of cooperation are portrayed on the slide. The most significant were related to U.S. organizations in MNCI area of operation. Our operational activities and effects. Portraying operational activity of MNDCS, this is necessary to present basic constraints and restraints to division to function under. In general, the most of constraints refer to rather insufficient status of stabilization process in Iraq, which is detailed on the current and following slides. Next. One of the most significant restraints affecting MNDCS performance was, as I said, multinationality. This is necessary to emphasize that despite multinationality of the division and in that respect, different national procedures, regulations, culture, and equipment, we succeeded to fulfill MNDCS mission and unite all the national contingent into a well-organized and effective tactical unit called One Mission, One Team. Next. The overall situation in MNDCS area of operation is assessed as relatively stable. In spite of the situation, we are still under the following threats. The first type will be Al-Qaeda and associated movement. The second type of threat are religious militias, mainly Mahdi militia and Badr organization. Right now, tense is high. We are observing the situation within the two organizations that could lead to potential violence. The third threat is a group called Army of Guardian. The group this group activities are dedicated mainly toward the weapon smuggling. Recently, there are increased indications that Mahdi militia and Ermo guardians have intensified their weapon buying efforts. And last but not least, we are concerned with the situation of the Iranian border. Contraband is smuggled across the border to include weapons, IED making materials, funding, and drugs. Additionally, we have frequent reports of Iranian operatives attempting to exert influence on Iraq's political situation. Additionally, of MNDCS, Staff G2 was a very well visible example of good cooperation between the division and higher level. The MNDCS G2 coordinated and synchronized intelligence operations of the staff subordinated units and national agencies activities in support the MNDCS commander's intelligence requirements. A significant part of proceeded information come from strategic MNFI and then operational MNCI sources to include DIA as well as from US HUMINT, Romanian HUMINT. The milestones of conflict between Shia and Sunni society were attack on Golden Mosque in Samarra, the 22nd February 2006, destruction of the Golden Mosque in Samarra temporarily caused a disaster for the stability of Iraq. The attack sent shockwaves of anger throughout the Shiite community. Muqtada al-Sadr remains influential. It is believed that he was reunified the Mahdi army since the Samarra mosque blast. Due to increased sectarian violence, murders, kidnappings, and other serious crime, thousands of civilians have fled to north and northwestern portion of Iraq for the peace of MNDCS. Almost 20,000 Iraqis fled to our area of operation. One of the direct results of the attack in Samarra was also an increase of IED and EFP attacks. Thanks to the effort of MNDCS troops nearer 40% of charges were found and diffused. Of course, we were equipped by U.S. side with very good mine sweeping equipment. A summary of attacks against the coalition forces in my division during the sixth rotation is shown on the slide. This is also necessary to emphasize that despite high amount of conducted operational task attacks against us during the sixth rotation of MNDCS, there were not any kill in action among coalition forces soldiers of my division. In the next part of my brief, I'd like to focus on specific operations conducted by MNDCS. Altogether, we conducted 87 operations, mainly, of course, supported 8th Iraqi Army Division, support for religious holidays, participant operations, cordon and surge operation, intelligence-driven operations, counter-insurgence operations, and counter-ID operations. Next piece. Our flag goes. Next piece. One of important operations which was conducted by a Iraqi Army Division was Ashura and Erbayan operation. The main task for this operation was to ensure security for 4 million pilgrims traveling to Karbala and Najaf throughout our area of operation. It was a very important operation for us because I learned from 2004 that during this operation, during this religious holiday, Iraq has received a lot of killed and wounded. During 2004 was killed more than 120 people and almost 300 were injured. Especially well-viewed example of American MNDCS Iraqi cooperation were operation related to securing Iranian border to include Operation Border 1, Border 2, and the biggest one, Iron Gate, which was conducted by our troops, by Iraqi Army, Iraqi Border Police, Iraqi Police during 2 weeks period of time, and each month these operations will start again. During the sixth rotation, MNDCS detained 27 terrorists and criminals. The most significant ones are presented on the slide. Next, please. Next. 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 Two of them, second and third, are policemen. Next, please. And this very important from Sunni population is accused for the assassination of the Polish TV journalist in 2004, and he's suspected of kidnapping and assassination of 2 US soldiers. It happened 3 months ago. Eight Iraqi division operation results. Next, please. MNDCS total activities, a lot of patrols, checkpoints. A specific area of MNDCS troops activity, especially worth highlighting, are EOD related actions during the sixth rotation of MNDCS. Nearly 270 tons of various explosives and ammo have been disposed. So it's very important because this kind of the explosive will not used by anti-Iraqi forces. Next, please. During sixth rotation, your concept of transition team deployment has been worked out and put into effects. Significantly, number of strengths of transition teams increased throughout the six rotations from Polish side, US side, and Ukraine. Next, please. Process of handover responsibility for controlling MNDCS area of operation to Iraqi army was driven mostly thanks transition teams' activity. Every day, transition teams were working together with Iraqi friends to accomplish mission and task given by MNDCS commander. Advising, training, and monitoring of Iraqi security forces were main tools used by them, as well as support during planning and executing phases of operation. 8th Iraqi Army Division, as the first Iraqi unit, will be directly fall under Iraqi Ground Forces Command from this month. It shows that effort done by MNDCS transition teams, training division, has not been wasted and allowed to speed up Iraqi security forces readiness. Next, please. Next area of MNDCS activity is extremely important for successful accomplishment of its mission was CIMIC, especially. Next. Fifth and influential part of CIMIC activities were projects related to reconstruction of public infrastructure. We completed planned to spend more than $70 million to comprise the next piece investment in electricity system. Next. Water and sanitation systems. Next, transportation. Next, education. Next, and healthcare. Next, please. Some conclusions and concern. The American-Polish bilateral partnership accounts significantly for strengthening and upgrading both transatlantic anti-terrorist coalition as well as the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It helps to build up confidence and harmonious cooperation between the coalition and the alliance members. Next. The participation on the Polish armed forces in Operation Iraqi Freedom has turned out to be both a great challenge and achievement within the transformation process. It provided our troops with a unique occasion to get access to the most modern technologies, equipment and tactics, techniques and procedures applied during one of the most difficult and challenging stabilization operations. It also brought quite new experience in areas of intelligence, special forces employment, and functions of internal security agencies. Poland, for the very first time, was assigned to organize and then led a multinational tactical division size unit comprising troops using different religions, languages, tactics, training procedures, equipment, etc., manned by people of different culture. I can proudly state that despite multinationality of the division and that respect difference listed just before, MNDCS succeeded to accomplish its mission. Next. Nevertheless, at the commander of the multinational division Central South of the 6th Shift, I can identify some concerns and drawbacks which should be taken under consideration or addressed in future. In general, they refer mostly to political instability in Iraq as well as slow and difficult process of development of Iraqi security forces. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes my briefing. Thanks very much for your listening to my presentation. Thank you very much.
Tunagruszka, thank you very much for those comments. And also, I think, if I may say, just being able to take a specific example of Iraq and your specific experience there, I picked out 3 points. Number one, this focus on troop requirements, rotational requirements, sustainability. How does one manage an operation as complex as this with a given troop level over time? Secondly, I think you raised the points of international coordination, interoperability, the kind of complexity of running an operation of this sort with an international coalition. And thirdly, you talked at the beginning about blurred missions. I was just struck by how many different missions and operations you're undertaking in this one area. Military operations, police intelligence, stabilization, reconstruction, medical support, civilian protection, training, policing, political negotiations. I think we're starting to get a sense of the types of operations that these types of conflicts are drawing out for countries such as Poland, the United States as well. I'm pleased to turn it now over to Jim, who I think is going to talk a little bit, if I don't want to preempt him on it, but about the importance of bilateral security cooperation with the United States in meeting precisely these types of threats. Jim, from here up the podium, whatever you prefer.
Well, good afternoon. It's great to be here. And Robin, thank you very much for giving me a platform for my maiden voyage in the think tank world. And it's great to see a lot of old friends here as well. I hope not to disappoint you this afternoon. I want to thank CSIS and the Fluor Corporation for making this conference possible. What I enjoy about my new job as Director of International Security Programs at the Atlantic Council is that now I can drill down into aspects of the transatlantic relationship that deserve more attention than I could give it when I was in government. Like CSIS, one of my priorities is transatlantic defense trade, particularly European defense industry, and how it, and the transatlantic defense trade generally, will be impacted by such institutions as the European Defense Agency. I look forward to joining with CSIS and others to figure out what is good for transatlantic business and what is not. I've been asked to provide remarks on two topics. Number one is the U.S. perspective on the evolving importance of defense partnering arrangements in meeting global security challenges, and the second, the cost and benefits of the changing U.S. security relationship with Europe in general and Poland in particular. First, defense partnering arrangements have never been more crucial than they are today. No one questions the importance of partnering arrangements of every kind to handle the global problems that we must address together. Those that may have once advocated the wrong-headed notion that the U.S. alone has the capacity to fix the problems we now face globally have been thoroughly discredited. The U.S. and the nations of Europe together have a big job ahead of us, and we need to be united in our approach. Unity does not come by itself. It takes hard work and patience to weld together a common effort. But we have no choice. We need to stop the transatlantic finger-pointing, get off the sanctimonious soapboxes, and get to work. We have already wasted enough time. What do I consider defense partnering arrangements? To me, partnering can mean any common approach that brings strong shoulders to push back on the problems that afflict us. At any one time, it could be the UN, NATO, the EU, regional partnerships, bilateral or multilateral partnerships, coalitions of the willing, but especially transatlantic defense industrial partnerships. For without the tools, we can't do the job. But what is key here is the following, and I want to emphasize this to those that are skeptical about partnerships. These partnerships must be militarily capable and must have the political courage to do the job. Many of the partnerships I have just mentioned have miles to go before they can take on the challenges that we need to take on today. We must not have partnerships for the sake of partnerships. We must have partnerships that work. This is not an impossible task, but it is one that we must press on with. That is why NATO reform and military transformation must work. That is why politicians and NATO capitals must realize, as Poland does, that unless they make military transformation a top priority, we will never be successful in pushing back those problems that press around us. Reform at the United Nations must continue. And as the European Union continues the development of its military capability, it needs to understand that it cannot field a military capability on the cheap, one that merely double hats manpower already committed elsewhere. We must deepen the common pool of forces that are capable, deployable, and sustainable in the field. We do not have enough of those forces in the pool today. If I had to single out a partnership that holds the most promise but needs the most work, it is the NATO-EU partnership, which is currently sterile. Now, about this so-called changing U.S. security relationship with Europe and Poland. Nonsense. I have worked on the U.S. transatlantic security relationship for most of my adult life, and I can tell you that the security relationship between the United States and Europe is not changing, except to grow even more intense and vital as we together figure a way out of the challenges that face us today. If anything, U.S. and European troops demonstrate every day on the battlefield, as we have just seen, how close our relationship has become. Now, the cost and benefits. The cost and benefits associated with both partnerships and this more intense U.S.-European security relationship are important to highlight. First, the costs of not developing partnerships is unbearable to the United States, to all of us. The United States cannot confront terrorism, failed states, and humanitarian disaster alone. And without strong U.S. leadership, a transatlantic approach sputters. There is another cost, too, and this is a financial and political one that nations must bear, and that is the cost of keeping military forces capable, available, and sustainable for the tasks at hand. Those nations allowing their military forces to atrophy with capabilities dating to the 1960s are not pulling their weight. Those nations that hold back when the call goes forth for forces to combat terrorism or to assist in difficult UN missions such as in Darfur or Lebanon should be ashamed. We all must shoulder the burdens together. The benefits of partnering and of a close U.S.-European defense relationship are obvious. Success, not today or tomorrow, not delivered by impatience or unreal expectations or faulty assumptions, but success won through patience, perseverance, stamina, political courage, and the strength that comes from unity. There is no other way, and we must get down to it. Finally, let me reflect a moment on the U.S.-Polish bilateral relationship, the bilateral defense relationship, because the evolution of this relationship bears the hallmarks of some of the points I've just made. In the early 1990s, it was Poland that was the first to knock, and knocked the loudest, on NATO's door demanding membership in the alliance. I was there. I remember those persistent knocks. It was Poland, too, that first began to send emissaries to the Pentagon, pushing to begin a new defense and military relationship with a DOD that still felt a little nervous sitting across from the uniforms that until just recently were only seen in the Warsaw Pact order of battle. It was Poland that led the way in getting the nations of the West to focus on stitching Europe back together again. However, what we also came to expect in those early meetings with our new Polish friends was to be handed across the table a list of military equipment that Poland wanted from the United States. These lists seemed to be arbitrary laundry lists of all kinds of equipment items that did not seem to have much coherence. It was unclear what planning underpinned those lists. Where was Poland trying to go with its Soviet-style military force structure? And what were we supposed to do about these lists? Accompanying these lists was also a rhetorical message that had two points. The first was, Poland had an accounts receivable with the West, because the West had somehow acquiesced to Poland's imprisonment for over 45 years. And two, its former occupiers were right around the corner and could come back at any moment. This time, Poland was going to be ready, and the West had better be ready too. Such lists and ideological struggles with historic events from another day were the manifestations of a new Poland emerging from the prison of communism and blinking in the new sunlight outside its prison gates. They were the early stirrings of an immature bilateral relationship which has now evolved from those first awkward days to today, where not only are our forces fighting together in two theaters, as we just heard from the general, but Poland is providing vital leadership. But more importantly, our political-military relationship is evolving towards a mature one, where we sit down as strategic partners and allies, forging a common approach to the problems of the day, not exchanging lists and expecting favors. Militarily, Poland has also come far from equipment lists of unknown heritage to a transformation based on strategic reviews, the latest one directed by my colleague Andrzej Karkowska. The days of a Warsaw Pact military are receding quickly, replaced by F-16s, UAVs, Humvees, and NATO force goals. But history dies hard, especially a history as heavy as that of 20th century Poland. Polish military thinking sometimes struggles hard to emerge from this past. The regional pressures and political instabilities that are always present in Poland's backyard do not call for a static force structure that was a hallmark of the last century, waiting for armored divisions to come spilling across its borders. We don't know what the future may hold, and some of those bad actors of the last century could certainly return in a new guise. But to be able to handle the surprise that will surely come, we must be nimble and able to move forces not just to the border, but to the next continent. Threats are no longer local, but global, and we must meet them as far from our homelands as we can. This calls for a force structure that can not only handle problems regionally, but globally as well. The future will also require a force structure that can undertake the full range of missions, and I think we saw that in your presentation today, from peacekeeping to high-intensity combat, sustainable and able to perform the chores of providing stability and reconstruction as Poles are doing so well today in Iraq. Polish transformation to a modern expeditionary force must continue to lead the way for other allies, moving away from fighting the last war to being prepared for the only certainty we know, and that is that surprise is right around the corner. Finally, in the years since those early meetings in the Pentagon, Poland has developed into a major European power, NATO ally, and strategic partner of the United States. With this prominence comes the tough political problem for Polish governments of telling the Polish people that burdens must be assumed by Poland, not because Poland will get something tangible in return, but because it is Poland's duty and responsibility as a major power to do so. This is one of the hardest things for a democratic government to do, because opposition parties and political pundits will howl that bills are paid in Polish blood and treasure without reward. In fact, such views are irresponsible, superficial, dangerous, and flat wrong. The bill paid when the wolf must be encountered at the door without the benefit of allies or a good stick is a terrible bill that Poland has paid consistently in the past. However hard it is to make the case to the Polish opposition and to the people, the case must be made for meeting the enemy far from the front door and together with allies. Not only are such actions smart, but with Poland's prominent position in the world, it is Poland's duty to join such actions without expectation of a reward to parade in front of the parliament and the press. Our work to shore up international stability needs the best brains of Poland's diplomats and the most capable soldiers of the Polish military. Poles have never stepped back when called into action. To close, as the Cold War began in 1948, Winston Churchill noted in the first volume of his war memoirs, The Gathering Storm, that Poland had now traded one master for another, and wrote, quote, "All our hearts are with the Polish people in their new subjugation, and we are sure we shall never seek in vain for their perennial impulse to strike against tyranny and to suffer with invincible fortitude all the agonies which befall them. We all look forward to the dawn." After 42 years, the dawn has finally broken for Poland, and the past 10 years have shown the world that Poland is moving confidently into a new day in partnership with the United States and with NATO. Thank you very much.
Jim, thank you very much for those powerful words, and also for putting on the agenda some of the topics obviously we hadn't touched on yet: NATO reform, the NATO-EU partnership, and obviously the issue of transformation and expeditionary warfare needs. It's now my pleasure to turn to Dr. Oscar, Ken Oscar. Thank you very much for your comments, perhaps looking a little bit more on the business side as well, and the economic and infrastructure side. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you. I've been asked to make some brief comments on industry's role in furthering cooperative defense alliances from both a security and economic perspective. CSIS, I think, focused on a word brief because I have a penchant for telling stories. It kind of reminds me of this young fella. He just graduated from the seminary, and he was assigned his first church in a small little Midwestern town, and he wanted to make a good impression for his first Sunday. So he practiced a sermon he got an A on in school, and he practiced it until he just had it perfect. That first morning, he climbs up to the pulpit, and he looks out, and there's only one old farmer in the whole church. And he didn't know what to do, so he climbs back down off that pulpit, and he goes up to the farmer, and he's kind of stone-faced. And he says, "Well, should I give my sermon?" And the farmer says, "Listen, sonny, even if there's only one cow out in my field, when I take my wagon load of hay out there, I feed them." And he thought, "That's feeding my flock. That's terrific." He climbs back to that pulpit, and he gives this sermon, and he embellishes it, and he puts everything he has into it. And he's looking down, and an old farmer is still kind of stone-faced looking forward. So he gets back down off the pulpit, goes over to the farmer, says, "Well, what did you think?" He says, "Listen, sonny, when I take my wagon load of hay out to feed my cows, if there's only one cow, I don't make him eat the whole load of hay." So I'll try to be brief. My comments really are centered on Fluor Corporation perspective, but they apply to all industry. And I see Boeing and Lockheed, the ITT, a lot of my friends here today, and they really apply to all companies. Fluor is an international engineering, construction, maintenance, and service company. We have four main objectives. The first is to our customers. We want them to benchmark us for dependability, expertise, and safety. We want our customers to sleep easy knowing that their important building project will be done right, on time, and on budget. Second, as a public company on a New York Stock Exchange, we want to consistently deliver superior earnings, growth, and return on investment to our stockholders and our owners. Third, to our employees, to be the employer of choice in the global building and service marketplace. And fourth, to have a positive impact on the quality of life of all communities that we work in. Now, what does it take for industry to go beyond selling products and services to making an actual investment in a country like Poland to improve their security, develop their economy, improve their quality of life, and to be a true partner in working with them in furthering cooperative alliances? An alliance is a partnership, as we've heard, between two parties where each provides something for the mutual benefit of both. On one side, industry wants a stable, safe environment, enforcement of laws, fair taxes. We would say zero taxes, but fair taxes. Integrity in business relationships and contract rules, and an opportunity to make the return on investment, which is obviously one of our four objectives from our owners. On the other side, countries want industry to make an investment. They want products made in their country so they can create jobs locally and build that economy and have it mushroom. They want industry to be environmentally correct. They also want to have integrity of relationships and contracts. And they want industry to assist the community and assist the defense of the country. In 1995, over 11 years ago, Fluor Corporation saw these conditions developing in Poland. We saw a country with one of the youngest and best educated populations in Europe. Even today, the average age, I think, is under 37. It's hard to believe you can go in a room and half the people are under 37. I don't think we'd make it here. I don't know. A country with many strong ties to the United States. We purchased a company called Prosekem in Gliwice. Prosekem was created in 1945 for the reconstruction and development of industry after the war. At that time, they specialized in the chemical industry. After we purchased them, we helped them expand into petrochemicals and then into oil, gas, and refinery products. They are now ISO 9001:2000 qualified. They've developed a high degree of design capability, and we send them our design work from all over the world through our computer systems. 2 years ago, there were about 400 engineers. Last month, I visited Poland, and I visited our company there, and there are now over 650 engineers. They have over 350 CAD-CAM stations where they do design work and architectural work that we send. They have all the latest software for project management, finance. They sponsor many community help programs with money, free computers, volunteer support. Clearly, Fluor has made an investment in Poland that has paid off for us and paid off for Poland. We are now helping other companies make such investments in Poland. For example, we are currently building factories and facilities for the 3M corporations in several different locations in Poland. Recently, LG from Korea announced its second LCD plant in Poland. Sikorsky is looking at the possibility of building helicopters in Poland, and Israel just announced a UAV facility. Fluor Corporation not only works for commercial customers, but we work for governments around the world. Fluor Corporation built the U.S. missile defense site in Alaska. Boeing did the missile, and we built all the buildings and sites, both in Chimney Island, in the Aleutians, and in Fort Greely in Alaska. Currently, the U.S. and Poland are in negotiations. If those come out fruitful, we would like our Polish company to build the next missile defense site in Poland, 100% Polish built. How does a company like Fluor help in bilateral defense alliances? First, I think, and it's not only industry, but I think it's think tanks like CSIS, help in good communications between the parties. Often industry has access to both sides of the negotiation and can ensure that there's an understanding of each other's position. Second, by helping provide technical data, program planning, analysis, and advice. I see, for example, you mentioned Poland's defense review, its emphasis on training. The U.S., helped by industry, has developed an excellent combined arms live fire tactical training that uses lasers and GPS. It has terrific feedback. Soldiers love it. It's like the old laser tag game. They get to run around, and instead of shoot trees, they can shoot each other with the lasers. They come back into a big auditorium, and they can play back where everybody was located, who shot who, get the feedback to themselves and their commander. It gives them a very high level of feedback and readiness for a very low cost. We have recently, Fluor Corporation, teamed with Cubic Corporation, and we have been developing very low-cost training simulators and war games. Hungary has bought one. Romania has bought one. Ukraine has bought one. They are NATO-compatible, and they allow the countries to train together and help this interoperability. Next Industry can help with the execution of approved alliance agreements, even offsets, heaven forbid, if they are necessary. Lastly, Industry can help share lessons from its wide range of global relationships and contracts. For example, we see right now considerable interest and uncertainty in the oil and gas market. Fluor Corporation is very large in the oil and gas business, and many companies and countries have contacted us about diversifying their supplies with many different ideas about sources, pipeline routes, transports, terminals, liquefied petroleum transport, how to store it. These discussions and data can be shared, and I think can make for better and more sound economic and security decisions. In summary, Industry, I think, can be a key partner in helping to create and execute defense and economic alliances. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ken, and thank you for leaving some hay in your still in your wagon. We appreciate that with the time that we've got left, and as I know that I think we've got about 15 minutes, I think, to be able to take some questions here. And we've had a number of three really very different presentations bringing different topics onto the table. If you do have a question, please do let us know who you are, who's asking the question. I think we have microphones, yes, waiting at the back of the room. Really, you can address your questions to any of our three speakers, and we have a wide range of topics to pick from, both from the industrial to the expeditionary through to the partnership relationships. Let me see if I have any takers right now, otherwise I'm going to take the chairman's prerogative and jump in myself. Looks like I'm going to jump in myself to start with. Well, let me start in a somewhat difficult spot, partly because you raised the word missile defense at the end there, Ken, but I'm not going to put the question to you. But maybe I could pass a question first to Jim, given his recent experience on the government side and so on. We heard a lot from General Grushka, really the expeditionary side of the bilateral relationship, and perhaps we could come to that in a second question. But let me take it back to you. You talked about the importance, Jim, of partnerships and partnerships for the future, U.S. leadership perhaps being defined in a more collaborative way in perhaps therefore thinking about the threats as well as how you meet them. Where do you see, missile defense is a very important component of this looking forward. It's an important element for this administration. How do you see that playing out in this bilateral relationship, and what kind of implications might it have for it?
Thanks, Robin. I appreciate that. it's interesting watching missile defense as an issue evolve over time. I went to NATO in 1998, missile defense as an issue there was radioactive. I could barely whisper it in the hallways without alarms going off. When the current administration came in, back in 2000 or so, of course, that became a big issue, the number one issue for the administration, certainly internationally, and I was thrust into the limelight of having to run this issue at NATO, and it was difficult there as well. And I think what we're starting to see as time has moved on is the fact that there is a role for missile defense becoming more and more accepted and more prominent as some of these bad actors that we've had to deal with globally are developing a capability that at one time was only seen as a theoretical thing, and that theory was debated by experts back and forth. Could you really do it, et cetera? Could a nation develop a capability, nuclear capability in the delivery systems? And as that began to, as this theoretical thing became reality, suddenly the issue was better able to be handled in a European context and NATO context. And so today, even in a bilateral context, I think the idea about missile defense involves deterrence. Certainly in the Cold War era and dealing with the Soviet Union, missile defense and the kind of threats we were trying to deter, it was a different time, a different set of players, a different strategic situation than we have today. And I think the role of missile defense in deterrence, the role of missile defense as a tool for the toolbox that the international community has or the transatlantic community has, is starting to be seen as something that we need to think about more actively. NATO is doing studies on its own for theater missile defense. But as we begin to talk to partners, potential partners bilaterally in Europe, nations there, about the potential of having a third site, it's not the radioactive issue it used to be. It is something now that is that where the importance of it, the role it could play, is becoming more accepted, and I think there's been a political recognition that we might need to be able to do something like that. So it is something that its day has come. And I think what we need to do is approach it in such a way politically and militarily that it does become a helpful tool as we deal with these nations that have come on the scene now with developing the capability to manufacture and deliver a nuclear weapon.
Thank you very much. That's a very fair point. Let me take a couple of questions here from the table. I might come back in a minute. Please, gentlemen here, and then we'll go there. Microphone's just coming behind you. The gentleman here, sorry, in this table here in the front.
Poster Taylor from Science Applications International Corporation. I'd like to, follow up from the comments that Jim just made on missile defense and then ask a somewhat broader question. On missile defense specifically, it may be instructive to look at the way NATO has actually proceeded over the last several years with a phased approach of first looking at feasibility, then looking at something akin to operational requirements, and now preparing within the next few days to actually award a contract to go to the next phase of defining current capabilities and what future needs might look like. That's going to be probably up to a 10-year effort and one that's going to involve all the nations and maybe a good model for actually how to bring industrial cooperation through an alliance like NATO to a specific operational problem. The question I'd like to ask is one, though, that goes directly, I think, to the heart of Jim's remarks. I certainly wouldn't dispute the desirability of industrial cooperation. I also wouldn't underestimate the difficulty of it, the political difficulty of it. And I just recall that in about 1996, a discussion I had with the then Assistant Secretary General for Defense Support, Norman Rae, about the desirability of inserting in NATO summit language a mutual commitment that a vital defense industrial base on both sides of the Atlantic was a desirable thing. The level of distrust and the political ramifications of such a mutual pledge proved to be overwhelming. So, without even being able to agree on a mutual commitment about what we ought to try to achieve in a transatlantic sense, it's difficult to see how we might move forward. And I would just ask Jim if he thought such language could be inserted in a summit now.
I agree with your statement and at the heart of your question as well. I think it could, but I will tell you, and many of you have had the same experience I have, developing business arrangements at NATO is difficult even on a good day. You know, I look back at NATO AWACS and I think what a miracle that was. But what was different then was that we had the pressures of the Cold War. I think the transatlantic defense industrial relationships and the state of industry in Europe were different then too. So the elbows are sharper now. But You know, the reason I would say I think we could is because there is this growing recognition on things like missile defense that we really don't have the luxury of time and sit there and get into these transatlantic squabbles about like we've been seeing with the NATO JSTARS equivalent, and that we've seen with ACTS and a number of other systems where it takes so long to come to an industrial arrangement that we all can live with. But I tell you what my hope is in this. I think, and I might be wrong here, but and this is what I'm going to be spending some time looking into. I think the transatlantic business relationships, represented by you, many of you all out there, is what's going to lead the way on this. If we let the political side of NATO try to organize it all, we're not going to get there from here. I have seen over the past couple of years, I think JSF is an example, I think there's some other examples of some pretty successful defense industrial partnering. And I've also seen strides, believe it or not great ones, but strides nonetheless, in the U.S. government and the Department of Defense as far as trying to loosen up a bit on the technology transfer and the business arrangements. I mean, it's better than it was. It's better than it was. I know there's cynicism out there, but and so my hope tip in this is that I think on a tactical basis, in terms of what we're facing now, in terms of the missile defense threat, I think that has grabbed some of the popular imagination, certainly in capitals. Number one. And that there's an understanding that we need to confront this. I think the second thing, too, is that the industry is probably better able now to lead the effort based on successful partnerings that we've seen over the past couple of years to come up with something that will work for both sides, because there's a lot the industry is going to gain from partnering, too. And it might be that it's industry that can put the arm on the political folks saying, look, let us work this out. Just give us the running room to do it. I think, given those facts I just talked about, I think we might be able to do that, and I think it's worth trying to. I'm not in the government now, but I might try my hand as best I can to try to get something like that in a communique, but more importantly, see if we can get some industrial movement on that, too.
I've got a couple of questions waiting here. Is your question an industrial one or not?
No.
Is your question an industrial one, Bill? Okay, well, maybe I could take these two comments on the industrial, and I'll come back to you if that's okay. Yes. Microphone.
What LORCORP did in Alaska for the missile interceptor site, can you say who did LORCORP beat out for that contract, and how much was that worth to you?
Maybe I'll take that as a very specific, quick answer question if you want.
Yeah, I don't know all the bidders. There are quite a number. The site cost about $350
million.
Bechtel, Parsons, WGI.
Okay, let me take the question from the gentleman there, this table here, and then Bill, I'll come to you.
Hi, my name is Gopal Ratnam, reporter with Defense News. It's a question for General Grushka. In the last slide, you mentioned a list of commanders' concerns, and one of them, I wrote it down pretty quickly, and I think you said the need to immediately and finally disband Al-Qaeda in Iraq. I was wondering if you could talk about what is it going to take to immediately and finally disband from your point of view, having been there.
As I said during my briefing, it was one of my concern how to solve problem in Iraq. We know that there are a lot of different issues, problem to solve, but from my point of view, one of the most important to do something with Al-Qaeda to reduce the ability to the lowest level, especially in Iraq, and then after it try to do it on all over the world. How? I think that we have got some solutions how to do it. Especially, I think the best one is to reinforce and to prepare Iraqi security forces in the proper way. So, as I said about 8th Iraqi Army Division, it's only one of the best prepared division in the Iraq. So it means that coalition forces should pay more attention to speed up the process of equipping, manning Iraqi security forces, especially Iraqi army, and after it, Iraqi police.
So I think we've got to come to a close in a couple of minutes. I think we have at least one of our next speakers with us now. I have two questions at this table. Bill, you were waiting first, and then the gentleman. Okay, well, if the mic's there, let's take the gentleman at the back first. Or do we have three questions? In that case, very quick.
I have a question for Mr. Townsend. Mr. Townsend said that Poland was one of the first countries that was knocking on the door to become part of NATO after the Cold War, and that Poland has never shirked from responsibility, always willing to go and take part in these missions. However, you also said that they shouldn't come with a list of equipment that they need to help them carry out these missions. Is there a level of hypocrisy in this when you look at American foreign policy, when the Western countries of NATO were rebuilt with the Marshall Plan using American money, and you have billions going to countries like Egypt just so that they won't blow up Israel, and billions going to Turkey, who is not willing to take part in these countries? I mean, is there a certain level of, do you reward friends at one point for helping out in these missions, or do you simply, you know, buy off countries for not blowing up others?
Quick questions, because as I said, I'm going to give each of the speakers a chance to reply at the end.
Vlad Kaczynski, University of Washington, School of Marine Affairs. My question is related to the issue of Poland's participation in global oceanic activities related to the theme we discussed today. And unfortunately, nothing was told about this factor. Poland was very active during the Persian Gulf, and I would like to also recognize the fact that the United States transferred to Poland two modern frigates. And I wanted to know if there are other plans to enhance Polish capabilities to participate in the naval activities of all over the world. Thank you.
Question. Bill, last at the front here, just very quickly, and then we'll close up.
Bill Siefkin, Lockheed Martin Corporation. I just wanted to address one quick question. Given the experience that we had in the past about the request being made for guidance, what role do you see for NATO and NATO-EU cooperation in guiding future acquisitions policies of the European partners and the United States as we seek to build interoperability on a transatlantic basis?
Let me just go through here. Ken, do you have any comments to make on any of these questions? You can let me. Let's go first, perhaps, with you, Jim, and then finish with General Grushka.
Thank you. Those are great questions. Let me, most importantly, make sure you understood what I meant by lists, and I'm sure it was vague out there. The lists were not equipment that the Poles needed to go off and do operations for NATO, that type of thing. We have, in fact, as Poland began to take part in military operations, we've had a very active program working with industry, working with the U.S. foreign military sales process, and with the U.S. Congress of making sure Poland had everything it needed to go out there. There's a good story to that, a lot of hard work. I think Ian Brzezinski around here could tell you some stories about that when he and I were working those issues. The lists came. I wanted to use that as an example because it showed how far Poland had gone in planning for its own military structure and what it felt it needed. From those early days when it was unclear because it was before joining NATO, that type of thing, it was something where it was Poland trying to sort out, is it equipment that really defines what our role is going to be in terms of taking part in national security and that type of thing. And obviously it's not. It's planning. It's joining the alliance. It's a lot of maturity and evolution happened from that point. So that was my point about the list. And I'd be more than happy to talk to you about those days.
If we can be very quick, because as you both thought, we need to break literally in the next 2 minutes.
Okay. Finally, let me just skip right straight to Bill Siefkin. And Bill, I think there's a very important role as far as NATO, European Union, and nations trying to sort out a transatlantic defense policy that makes sense. What I would say, though, and this is my last point and I think most crucial, it is really important that I think that we let business take the first crack at sorting it out. I mean, that's one thing after 23 years of government I've come away with. is let's not get in the way of business, because usually they can find the more efficient way to go. I think policy pointers are needed, but let's not let those be barriers. Let's let those be pointers. So I think that's something that's on the agenda for the transatlantic community.
Thank you, Jim. General Grushka, do you want to say something while you're...
I think that will conduct operations, naval operations too. As you know, for example, from European Union countries, it's preparing a new big mission to Lebanon. And we learned that, for example, a lot of countries like Germany are going to send to Lebanon contingents as a Navy contingent, almost I think 2,500 troops. We'll see. I think that we are ready to be a part of the operations on the sea too. Thank you.
Well, please give a hand to all of our speakers here. And seats, I think, yes, and then we'll have to.
Sorry? Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I apologize for interrupting your conversations, but I don't have enough time to get done here what we're going to want to get done. We've got a great, great afternoon before us. We welcome back Radek Sikorski. I'm so glad he's back in town and not as a competitor. You know, I mean, people may remember that he really made big waves in town when he was over at the American Enterprise Institute, and I'm so damn glad that he went into government and got, you know. Seriously, he was a wonderful friend and just did remarkable work while he was here. The other thing that just irritates the heck out of me is that he's a guy who is at least 15 years younger than me and has accomplished more. I better get used to that. You know, I mean, that's, I guess, my lot in life now. But I'm delighted he's here. And, of course, I'm going to be very brief with introductions. I'm also delighted that Gordon England is here. Gordon, one of the very finest deputy secretaries we've ever had, and is doing such a splendid job at DOD. And it's a capstone to a remarkable career. Matter of fact, Minister Sikorski is going to go down tomorrow to fly an F-16, and of course everybody remembers that Gordon was the pioneer that brought the F-16 production line roaring in. So it's actually, we're closing the circle here with these two great leaders today. We've got a special thing that we want to do. You're all going to be very touched by that. The government of Poland would like to make a special honor and recognition for two very important people today. Let me turn to Minister Sikorski to get this started.
Thank you very much, John. It's great to be back in town. We have a saying in the Polish Ministry of Defense, a day without flattery is a day lost. You do very well in our ministry. Thanks so much. And as you mentioned, I would like on behalf of the government to call on Lieutenant Colonel Anna Nain and on Lieutenant Frederick Benkowski, who are respectively... a veteran of the Battle of Britain, in which Polish pilots served with distinction in the darkest hour of Europe. Mr. Benkowski was a navigator, and just a couple of days before we take the delivery of the first Polish F-16s, I am so very glad that we can meet and appreciate one of the heroes of the Polish Air Force here in America. And at a moment when Polish and American soldiers are fighting together in Iraq, where they are standing up for freedom, for democracy, for the values that both of our nations feel so passionately, I'm glad that I can personally thank you, Colonel, for the contribution that you made so that our forces may collaborate as successfully as they are doing in the field.
And therefore, on behalf of the government of Poland, I would like to thank you.
It is my great pleasure to address you today on the occasion of the visit of the Prime Minister of Poland, Jarosław Kaczyński, to the United States. I believe that the visit will further contribute to the partnership between our countries, a partnership that, as I mentioned before, is built on values, shared interests, and the will to act together. The foundations are strong and solid because they are based on common perceptions of the security environment, which is today increasingly unpredictable. We face the same evil of terrorism and the same evil of the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Regional conflicts, dictatorships, and authoritarian regimes, also on our own Polish border, continue to affect our security and our interests. We must engage them. Appeasement is not an option. Most of those challenges can be overcome only through partnership between Europe and the United States. Our Polish-American partnership is also built on the assumption that security and stability should be extended, including through the enlargement of Euro-Atlantic institutions. U.S. political support and practical assistance was instrumental and vital for Poland to join NATO. You promoted this idea to its successful end in 1999, and we don't forget that. Today, our strategic priorities have not changed. NATO remains the cornerstone of Poland's security and the important platform for our partnership with the US. We need your strong commitment and your leadership in the alliance, which is the best coalition the world has ever seen. Acting alone is always tempting and sometimes necessary, but in most cases, a truly joint endeavor brings more enduring effects. Our partnership is best proven by action in time of need. We went into Iraq with you because we felt sympathy for the victims of 9/11 and because we have seen such tragedies in our history ourselves. It's been a highly complex and demanding operation for us, and we've suffered casualties. We've suffered, in fact, the highest casualties in combat since the Second World War. The operation has, we are glad to have received American assistance to fulfill our mission, but it's also been a drain on our resources. We've had to make choices between operations and modernizing our own forces. We are extending our commitment to the Lebanon as I speak, and we will go in force next year in Afghanistan. We will therefore have to choose and consider the scope and character of our further involvement in Iraq. But when we withdraw eventually, militarily, we will of course remain committed to the stabilization process in Iraq. Afghanistan is a distant country for us, even though I personally have visited in all kinds of capacities. In the 1980s, I spent some years with the Afghan Mujahideen there as a reporter. But we are very aware that making it stable and prosperous will not be able to make it stable and prosperous. We need to take control over the terrorism there. Besides, we in Poland feel a great deal of sympathy for the Afghan people because of their courage and the commitment that they made to defeating the evil empire in the 1980s. The fates of Poland and Afghanistan were intertwined at least twice. In 1980, when Solidarity created its peaceful revolution, the Soviet Union was already engaged in Afghanistan. And many historians think, and I agree with them, that the Solidarity revolution could have been cut off much more brutally than it was if the Soviet Union had not already been engaged in Afghanistan. And then throughout the 1980s, what Mr. Gorbachev called a bleeding wound cost the Soviet Union at least $100 billion. And that was $100 billion in those days for a communist power was a lot of money. And it was perhaps that money that Mr. Gorbachev lacked for consumer spending, for internal reforms, which contributed to the fact that the Soviet Union collapsed in the way that it did In other words, with the loss of control by the Communist Party, with the dissolution of the Outer Empire in the form of the Warsaw Pact, which is, of course, what brought Poland independence and freedom. So when we see the fate and the difficult straits in which the Afghan people still are, we feel solidarity. And solidarity is an important word for us. And which is why we have decided to send soldiers to protect a Swedish PRT in Mazar-i-Sharif. We've been demining the Bagram Air Base under U.S. control for some years now. And from February next year, over 1,000 Polish soldiers, including a mechanized infantry battalion, will be taking part in the Operation Enduring Freedom and will be there to strengthen our hand against the Taliban and the remnants of Al-Qaeda. Common approach to countries on strategic crossroads is also a great challenge and opportunity for our partnership. Poland is, as I've already mentioned, particularly interested in the stabilization of the post-Soviet area. We continue to share with those countries our experience and want to cooperate more closely with the US on spreading our values. I think the Polish-US partnership during the Orange Revolution was important, and it contributed to the success of the Orange Revolution, which, whatever we may see now in Ukrainian politics, has changed that country forever. It was also in that part of the world that Europe was faced for the first time with the issue of energy security. The crisis between Russia and Ukraine has made us aware of the fact that some countries use energy as a geostrategic weapon, and whereas we want to buy more energy from all who produce it, I think Poland and the US are as one in being against monopolies and against energy being used to affect other people's security. Poland wants to get more integrated with NATO structures, NATO systems. We've been a member for 7 years now, but it was only this year that we've taken the decision to join NAPMO, and by the end of the year we should be a 3% shareholder in the AWACS fleet, which will mean that the F-16 planes that are finally starting to arrive later this year will be fully compatible with the rest of NATO. We're grateful to the United States for the C-130s that should start arriving next year, and we're also looking forward to taking delivery of unmanned air vehicles. We would also like for NATO facilities to be more evenly spread over the entire area of the alliance, which is why we have declared our willingness to give something that is perhaps our best airfield in Powidz for the ground base of the proposed NATO-allied ground surveillance operational base. Poland is a country where Americans are welcomed, where NATO has a good, strong, positive trademark, and we think it would be a great symbol of trust and also a token of NATO being interested in the security of its new members as much as its traditional old members. Finally, a word on European security and defense policy. Poland is a good ally of the United States, but it's also a loyal European and a European country, and we are joining various European initiatives. In the last 9 months, we've joined the European Corps of Gendarmerie. We have sent a contingent under the EU flag to the Democratic Republic of Congo, and we've joined the European Defense Agency's code of conduct in respect of defense procurement, which I believe will be hugely to the benefit of American companies, because it is, after all, American companies based in Europe that have the best experience of the kind of scale, continental scale of operation that code of conduct makes possible. Finally, let me say how delighted I am to be here, but also how nervous, because to be flying tomorrow over Secretary England's hometown in an F-16, whose pilots are famous for wanting to impress the VIPs with the operational and particularly the G-force elements of the planes is something that I'm looking forward to, but also I'm nervous about. And let me assure you, my breakfast tomorrow will be a very light one. Thank you.
We don't need a long introduction for Gordon. When I went upstairs to try to meet him, I said, "Have you seen the secretary?" And he says, "Yes, he's walking across the tidal basin right now on his way." So welcome this water walker here from the Pentagon. Gordon, please.
Actually, John, I was tempted to walk as I left the Pentagon. I said, you know, for the last few days, it's been freezing in the Pentagon, you know, because either the air conditioner's on or the heat's on. You know, the government's one or the other. There's no in between. You can't open the windows. I've been freezing. I said, you know, I'm going to go to CSIS. At least I'll warm up for an hour. By the way, Mr. Minister, I do suggest you have a light breakfast tomorrow morning. You will get to pull 9 G's, and you will have bragging rights over a lot of other people who have never, you know, when I was backseat F-16, I got my 9G pin. I didn't realize that I'd ever be Secretary of the Navy. And of course, Navy pilots don't pull 9 G's, right, because they have F-18. They pull 7.5 G's. It's held me in very good stead all these years as I went out and visited carriers and all. So you'll have a wonderful trip, and I hope you do have a wonderful trip tomorrow. John Hamry, I thank you for hosting this event. You and CSIS always do a wonderful, wonderful job. Fluor Corporation, I thank you. Ken, it's terrific of you to pick up the tab and make all this possible, so I thank you. Mr. Minister, I thank you. I thank you for being here. It's terrific to be here with you today. I've been looking forward to seeing you, and we always had wonderful times and conversations together, so it is a delight to share the day with you today. For everyone here, I also thank you because you obviously all have an interest in U.S.-Polish relationships in both of our countries, and I think that's just wonderful to see this great turnout of people with this common interest. It is also a pleasure that we're welcoming the Prime Minister Kaczynski to Washington today, and his visit alone is a mark of the strong partnership our nations enjoy. I'm sorry that the Ambassador Ryder could not be here today. I know he's with the Prime Minister because we get together frequently, enjoy each other's company, and always have some good conversations. So I'll have to see him another time, but I understand he is with the Prime Minister. That's a great way to be spending the day. Let me take just a minute to make a comment about Minister Sikorsky, because you know, his own life is, frankly, a reflection of Poland's great struggle for freedom and its success. At a most critical time in his country, when the Soviets cracked down on Poland in the early 1980s, he was courageously standing up at that time for liberty, and he was a student strike committee leader, which wasn't a very popular thing to do back then during the Soviet regime. And so, Mr. Minister, I just want to tell you, I admire you for your background and for what you have done for Poland and what you're still doing for Poland, and I'm sure what you will be doing for Poland far into the future. We have a shared history of standing together, the United States and Poland. If you go right down the blocks, a few blocks away, there's a dramatic statue that celebrates the life of General Puchowski. And as many of you know, he was a Polish citizen who stood up to the forces of aggression against his own nation in the name of freedom. Then he chose to come to our shores, and he joined the cause of the American Revolution, which is why his statue is here in Washington, in the name of freedom. So he literally, his for freedom, he came to America and fought with us. He served heroically and selfishly with his American brothers in arms, and he gave his life in battle for liberty. Later, during the Cold War, when the Polish people faced years of hardship and oppression, the United States stood firm against the Soviet threat and reached out to the Polish people at every opportunity in support. And we rejoiced together, Americans and the Polish people, when the wall fell in 1989, and a new day and a new dawn of independence for Polish arrived. America continues to rejoice at the extraordinary progress, and it is extraordinary progress, that the independent Polish nation has made in a very, very short time. We have a robust market economy, a thriving democracy, and membership in NATO and in the EU. And by any measure, Poland today is a leader on the world stage. They literally have thousands of troop forces deployed. You heard that from the minister, but literally thousands of their forces are deployed. They make very important contributions in Iraq and Afghanistan, and are also a key contributor to EU and the UN-led missions. They're a mentor to many other countries as they move down the path of freedom. They're supporting the transformation underway in the Ukraine and in Georgia, and are urging Belarus in the same direction. And they're demonstrating what a commitment to peace and stability means in the Middle East. They've been pledging resources for reconstruction and humanitarian assistance, and their troops to augment UNIFIL in Lebanon. For the United States, Poland's a very close friend and a key strategic partner, standing side by side with America and around the world in the name of freedom and liberty. And this nation is indeed deeply grateful for the sacrifices of the Polish military, the will and commitment of the Polish government, and the friendship of the Polish people. As President George Bush said just a few months ago during President Kaczynski's visit, we're strong allies and friends, and we are friends in liberty. This is a friendship tested by time. It's also a friendship tested by fire. By any measure, this is now. This is a critical point in history. It's a critical point in history for America, for Poland, and for every free-loving nation. Terrorists have declared their intention to destroy our very way of life. And by the way, they have various websites. You can go to those websites and you can read exactly what their intentions are. As the president said just 2 days ago on the anniversary of 9/11, we are in a war that will set the cause for this new century, and it will determine the destiny of millions across the world. So this is the fundamental challenge of our time, of this generation. And all free-loving nations are at risk. No nation and no people are immune. It's a threat we cannot ignore. In the 1930s, a repressive regime threatened the freedom of its neighbors in Europe. And at that time, the world did too little, and it was too late. And Poland is one of those nations that suffered the consequences. And we cannot afford, the world cannot afford, to make that mistake again. Today, together, we face another fundamental threat to our very way of life. And this is not a time to be timid. It's a time for everyone who loves liberty and freedom to stand together. It's a time for leadership. It's a time for commitment and resolve. This is a war of will. This is will, commitment, determination, and resolve. America's answer to the challenge today is freedom. The president said, we will act boldly in freedom's cause. And 5 years after 9/11, we remain steady in our purpose and rock solid in our resolve. The president has not wavered. And I was with the president on 9/12 when he came to the Pentagon, when the Pentagon was burning and the lights were flashing and you could smell the fires and feel the oil in your hands in the Pentagon. And when the president came in and met with Secretary Rumsfeld and the service chiefs and the service secretaries, at the time I was Secretary of the Navy, and other officials in the Department of Defense, and the president said, never forget. He said, never forget what happened this day. And he said, the nation needs to go on, the world to go on. He said, but I will never forget, and you can never forget, because we are charged with defense of freedom and liberty. He said, and get ready. He said, this is going to be a long war. This is not going to be removing a mole. He said, this is going to be removing a cancer. So be prepared for a long war and get the military ready. It will be economic, it'll be diplomatic, it'll be military, but the military must succeed. And I will tell you, the president has not wavered one bit since 9/12, and he ain't going to waver. And I think he reaffirmed that on 9/12 or 9/11 just 2 days ago when he spoke to the nation one more time, because this is the fundamental struggle of our time. For the United States and Poland together, ensuring the triumph of freedom over tyranny and terror means continuing to bolster our strong bilateral relationship and then building on it to extend the promise of freedom to those who have known far too little of it. One part of our relationship is defense transformation. America's Quadrennial Defense Review and Poland's Strategic Defense Review call for strengthening our joint abilities to meet more asymmetrical challenges. We are working together as we reorient to achieve the strategic vision. Another key part of our relationship is interoperability, making sure that our forces can operate together seamlessly in real-world conditions today and in the future. And as the minister said, this week's rollout of Poland's first F-16 undershares that shared commitment. It opens the door to close unit-to-unit partnerships, and it gives us a common stake in technology. And I'm particularly pleased, again, that the minister will be visiting Fort Worth and firsthand getting to fly the airplane and to accept the airplanes on Poland's behalf. Now, our close partnership in the air joins a long-standing partnership on the ground. Before the war in Iraq, we had the annual victory strike exercises between the U.S. Army 5th Corps and the Polish 2nd Corps. With literally thousands of soldiers, sophisticated technology, and close to real-world conditions, and it gave our ground forces the opportunity to build close, strong relationships. And they've been very important to us and very important to Poland. Now, these exercises proved to be a crucible for our work together in Operation Iraqi Freedom, where Poland's efforts are shining examples of courageous service and quick adaptation. 230 years after a Polish general officer gave hope and support to the American struggle for liberty, American and Poland together are helping extend the same promise and hope to the Iraqi people. The Polish-led multinational division, Central South, trains Iraqi counterparts, helps support every facet of the complex missions of governance and reconstruction, and successfully carries out the delicate diplomacy of leading a truly multinational effort. Secretary Rumsfeld and I, and the U.S. government as a whole, remain deeply grateful for Poland's staunch support and superb leadership, not just support, but their leadership in Iraq. I'm especially pleased to see here today Major General Gruszka, who led a brigade in a challenging environment of the holy city of Karbala and then returned to serve as commander of MND Send South. And I thank him for his service, commitment, and partnership. General, well done. So working together, the United States and Poland are helping build and strengthen the capacity of new partners, like Iraq and Afghanistan. And we're also working together to update long-standing alliances. The U.S. government appreciates Poland's ongoing support for NATO transformation, ensuring that NATO has the expeditionary capabilities it needs to respond to emerging security challenges. We are indeed truly privileged as a nation to have a staunch ally and friend as Poland, and America is committed to this partnership. This is truly a special relationship. It's tested by time, tried by adversity, and cemented by the blood we share together in Iraq. It's a relationship that's not based on transactional considerations. It's not something you can reduce to dollars on the bottom line. Rather, it's based on fundamental values shared by the American and the Polish people, literally over the centuries. It's a rock-solid foundation of partnership that gives us tremendous opportunities to continue to learn from one another and to extend the great promise of the freedom and liberty that we enjoy together, and together we'll leave that same peaceful environment of freedom and liberty to our children and to our grandchildren. And I thank you very much, Mr. Minister, and John, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Thank you.
Gordon, thank you very much. Let me say to all of you colleagues, we have the minister and the secretary both must depart really sharply at 2:30 because of obligations they have to get across town. So we've got about 15 minutes for questions, and I would like, let's start over here if I can. I'll just please indicate, and I'll call you. Go right, yeah, bring the mic right down to the front table.
I was glad to hear Minister Sikorski's remarks about ESDP, and congratulations also on your appointment and your remarks. One of the previous speakers described the EU-NATO relationship as one of unfulfilled promise, and he also described, Jim Townsend said, it was a sterile relationship. So I'd be interested in your perspectives on whether that's the case and whether it can be improved.
I'm no good on the minutiae of these documents and the bureaucratic shuffling that takes place in Brussels, but I can just tell you how we think about it at the MOD, and this is that we use the best tools for the job. And so, for example, the Congo operation, there was no interest from the United States. As Europeans, we decided it was an important job. We in Poland don't have many traditions of involvement in the Congo. Joseph Conrad wrote The Heart of Darkness there, but that's about it. So we use the EU tool, and we're also in the Operation Althea in the Balkans. As the US draws down, we built up, hopefully we'll draw down too. And I just don't see any contradiction. There will be places, particularly on Europe's periphery, where we as Europeans should take charge of our own security and should have the instruments to do so. And I think most of the time the U.S. will be pleased.
Right back here, Sanjay, and then we'll come.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you so much for wonderful remarks by Minister Sikorski and Dr. Ingerland. And my question is, Ms. Sikorski, you did touch on two issues. First, energy security issues, and second, on European Defense Agency. EU as a whole, depending on 20% of energy, gas supply from Gazprom. Poland depending on 60% of gas from Gazprom. My question is, at the moment, European Commission President Barroso want to create a super regulatory regime to regulate monopoly and energy issues. Could you offer your view whether this is a good thing? And second, EDA. When you look at EDA, UK and France spend about 70% EDAs and R&D budget. On one hand, in France, want to use EDA as enhance perhaps ramping up research and development budget within in Europe and create European project. On the other hand, UK sees EDA as a referee to perhaps use a mechanism to consolidate cross-border procurement project. Could you please answer what is the policy government views on European Defence Agency? Thank you very much.
On both issues are somewhat tangential to my responsibilities, because in Poland the defense ministry doesn't actually either own or regulate the defense industry, unlike in some other countries. But our thinking is relatively straightforward, which is to say that, you know, we in Europe spend a lot of money on defense, but we spend it less efficiently than you do in the United States. And there are too many producers of APCs and various other types of equipment, and we want to gain the kind of economies of scale that you have so successfully created in the United States, so that our defense euros, or zlotys even, can be spent on training and operations and on modernization. So it's in that spirit that we joined, even though, I have to tell you, it was a controversial move in Poland, because the trade unions were arguing that, you know, Poland is not quite ready yet, even our largest enterprises are small by European standards. But I think competition makes you better on the whole, and that a continental-scale industry will eventually emerge that will be a good partner, and let's face it, sometimes a good competitor for the United States. On energy, I think we all want to diversify. The United States diversifies perhaps somewhat away from the Middle East. We want to buy more and more at the cheapest price, but I think we all agree, as I said in my initial remarks, that monopolies and blackmails and political pressure is just unacceptable. But I think here the European Union has important legal and financial instruments, because the Russian Federation wants to sell more energy to Europe. It's perfectly understandable. It also wants to buy gas distribution networks. Again, maybe sound business. But what should, in my personal view, happen in return is that it should open its own domestic market to competitive practices. And it's in that spirit that we have the European Energy Charter. And we want to free flow of gas and we want investments to be possible in both directions, not just one. And we also want newly emerged states in Central Asia to be able to export their energy to European markets.
Right down here in the shirt, and then we'll go behind.
Thank you. Rob Smith with the Hudson Institute. Minister, my question is also about energy security. Russia recently shut down oil supplies to the Mazeikiu refinery in Lithuania, in which Polish company PKN Orlen just bought a majority share. This has implications for national security as well, especially for Lithuania and Poland. What role do you see Brussels playing, as both these countries are now EU and NATO members? What role do you see Brussels playing in helping to resolve this situation?
I really don't want to delve deeper into it, because these are business decisions that I don't have full knowledge of. But first of all, you're neglecting Secretary England. And secondly, this is really not my area of responsibility, and I wouldn't want the energy minister to be angry with me.
He's going to be prime minister someday, with a judgment like that. Right.
Mr. Minister, Jim Wolf, Reuters. Hi. Have you made any progress in any discussions of Poland's hosting a third anti-missile site in your talks at the Pentagon? What issues remain to be resolved, and what's your sense of how likely this is and when it might take place?
I think that's a question for Secretary England, because I think it's a U.S. initiative. We, of course, love to do things with the United States as the husband of an American citizen, as a former honorary Washingtonian. I'm perhaps at the forefront of that, but. And I think in general Europe needs missile defense, and Poland is engaged in the NATO system, both in the theater missile anti-missile defense and the strategic system. But a lot of what you're reading in the newspapers is what we call in Poland media facts. as opposed to real facts. You're, I'm sure, aware that there have been some very exploratory, low-level technical consultations. But you know, if we are asked to host such a base, of course we'll answer in the spirit of alliance solidarity.
We've got.
But has there been any progress then? Has anything advanced during your visit and during the Prime Minister's discussions, as far as you know?
Not to my knowledge, no.
We've got. I'm going to ask you just to get your question quickly, and then I'm going to aggregate them. So start with you right here. Short question.
Christoph Marshall, I'm the U.S. correspondent of the German Daily Der Tagesspiegel.
Hi, Christoph.
Hi, Radek. I have a question to both of you. I would be interested again to the relation between Polish-American, but also Polish-European relationship and cooperation in the defense sector. How has that developed over the last years? We all know that a few years ago, at the beginning of the Iraq War, Europe was divided. How has this developed when you meet now your colleagues? We had elections, government changes in Germany, Poland, Italy, Spain. How is cooperation today? Is there still a problem? Are people looking to the rear mirror, or are they looking to the front shield?
I'm going to get these three questions asked real quickly. This lady at the same table and the man right beside. And short questions.
Thank you, Mr. Minister. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Mr. Minister, welcome back to Washington. It's good to see you again. My question actually to Esther Brimmer's Center for Transatlantic Relations, Johns Hopkins, is actually to both of you. Increasingly, military assets are being used in crisis response, whether post-Katrina or NATO operations after the earthquake in Pakistan. Could you both comment on the role of military assets in crisis response and working with civilian military cooperation, that kind of crisis response? Thank you.
Okay, and last question.
Yes, actually this one is for both. I would like you both to comment, given the fact of that MED has gone into discussion. Okay. The defense shield has gone into discussion. I would like you both to comment on the bilateral defense.
Hold it up by your face so we can hear.
Okay, bilateral defense agreement between United States and Poland, which I understand most countries in Europe have, but I am not certain what the status is between the United States and Poland.
Okay, this is like speed dating. Okay, you guys have got each got 2.5 minutes.
Shall I start?
Yes, please.
Well, I'll start at the end. Well, I think a bilateral agreement is an excellent idea, particularly in the hypothetical instance if the U.S. were to ask us to host a missile defense base, because you know, as a former Washingtonian, I love to, and as defense secretary, I love to work with the United States, but I'm also a politician in Poland, and I need to prove to the Polish people and to Parliament, because such a base couldn't happen without a bill in Poland, that as a result Poland's security would increase. And as you know, there are concerns over that. Such a base would be a target. It would be a target of nuclear strikes, of terrorist threats, of increased penetration by foreign intelligence services. In other words, there would be downsides. And I would need to go in front of Parliament and say, well, why? You know, overall, it's a good package, and it would have to be a package of which such a bilateral agreement, as well as support for Poland's air defenses, would, I think, be a very welcome part. On crisis response and CIMIC, very good question. I am particularly proud of our performance in Iraq. The statistics that I have read suggest that we have had the lowest, in our sector of Iraq, the lowest ratio of Iraqi civilian casualties. And we are very proud of that. And I think it's not unconnected to the fact that we have also had very relatively low casualties. We haven't lost anybody for 18 months, touch wood. So the Polish military seems to have found a formula for working with the Iraqis. And I had the Iraqi defense minister in Warsaw just last week, who was I think genuinely saying that the 8th Division that we trained and that the U.S. has certified as capable of taking control is good. And so we're hoping to rely on those skills also in Afghanistan. It's perhaps to do with our religiosity and our experience of being a weaker partner of trauma, that somehow we relate quite well to countries in which we perform peace missions. But we've also had a lot of experience. We've been in peacekeeping operations for 40 years now. It was in the UN context in the communist times, but now it's in the UN context, coalitions of the willing, and NATO context, and military to military relations. Christoph, well, they seem, I think, particularly good between Poland and Germany. Actually, I've had my German colleague Dr. Jung in Poland at least twice during my this year already. It was partly at his request that we sent the Polish contingent to the Congo, because Germany had a leading role in generating those forces. And just a month ago, I hosted a meeting of defense ministers in the Weimar Triangle formula. We actually held it 300 meters underground in the Wieliczka salt mine in Krakow, which was very good for security.
Gordon, we've got a few minutes, and I'd love to have your response.
So let me address the second one, since that was mill assets. The question was, do we use them for other purposes, particularly civilian? Of course, we deployed for the tsunami and deployed the next morning. Remember, the aircraft carrier was leaving within 24 hours. And same with Pakistan, same with Katrina. We had literally 70,000 troops in Katrina and a lot of our equipment, ships, 400 and some helicopters, I believe, all that deployment all happened very quickly. The tsunami, by the way, I thought was interesting, because early on people said, gosh, you know, the United States should be putting more funds into the tsunami. And I thought it was sort of interesting that we literally send billions of dollars of assets. I mean, if you think about it, you send carriers and all that equipment, that's investment by people over literally generations. I mean, it's billions, tens of billions of dollars of assets were deployed in support of the tsunami. I'm probably the only nation in the world that could do that. We do it. We have the assets, and obviously we will continue to do that. We did that in the middle of our fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, other deployments. Everybody's talking about their stretch military, but at the end of the day, we somehow always find the resources to do what we have to do for humanitarian crisis. We'll continue to do that. Bilateral defense agreement, my view is we'll wait to see what happens. Obviously, we're interested in a deployment site, missile deployment site in Europe. Those discussions are ongoing, and I guess depending on how that comes out, then we'll take the next step and decide what we do, depending on where it is, and et cetera. And Frank, I never did catch the first question. I mean, I was still never quite heard that question. I guess, Chris, is that you in the back? I didn't. So if you can just tell me what that first question was, I'll try to...
It was the state of relations, I think, between Europe and Poland and how America views that and American-Polish. Is this sort of the difference between how much is looking to the
real world, or let me tell you, I think a characteristic of America is we're always looking through the windshield. The front screen, I mean, that's our characteristic. I think that's not true with a lot of nations in the world. I think it is true with Poland now. I think a lot of nations still look back, and that's part of the problem we have in the world, by the way. There's nations, and in fact, you might think that the terrorists are looking in the rearview mirror to 1,000 years ago in a lot of cases. But I would say we're always looking forward, and relationships are hugely important. In the QDR, we talked about our partnerships. And you have my comments. I mean, this is a worldwide struggle, and it's going to take worldwide partnership and cooperation, and that's what we're all about. So it is worldwide partners and cooperation. I can tell you that's our objective in the future. And we're getting a high sign.
Comments, please. Thank you.